Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people will start dropping in from the Philippines, Pakistan, England and Australia. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences about people power that are too often missed by mainstream media. Campaigners who are linking up around the world to claim a fairer future for people and the planet. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. As an editor and journalist working with progressive publications, our readers often say, why all the doom and gloom? Violence and scandal have their place, but when you compare it with good news, it's a dreary diet. Corruption and conflict can make people scared, cynical, withdrawn and depressed, feeling it's all hopeless, I give up. But serve up something inspirational and hope and energy come to the table. Throughout this year, the Radio New Internationalist team has been blown away by the power and passion of progressive voices from every corner of the world. People who have seen the worst in the world and have stood up and offered other answers. They've linked up with people from other countries and built ever-strengthening movements. They've delivered messages that are so powerful and clear that politicians have to listen. Their energy is inspirational. Their achievements sparkle. This program is dedicated to all of them, but unfortunately you'll hear only some of them today. Let's start in an unlikely place. The offices of banks and accountants. Africans are poor. Everyone knows that. But they needn't be. On current estimates, for every dollar of aid that flows into Africa, $5 of financial assets flow out into private bank accounts in the rich world. Money that's never taxed. For African economies, straining under the burden of debt and the conditions that are placed on it, tax revenue means self-reliance, economic freedom, and money to improve education and health. So why are African countries relying on aid rather than taxing those who profit most from their countries? In what is emerging as a major social justice issue for this decade, John Christensen is challenging the accountants and politicians of the world to go figure. Now a director and founder of the Tax Justice Network, he tells us how countries' coffers are being plundered to leave populations in poverty and in the process proves how vibrant and important tax issues can be.
Look, the fact of the matter is that over the past half century, whilst we've been looking the other way, bankers, lawyers and accountants have been quietly building up what I call a parallel economy, a shadow economy, which consists of an offshore infrastructure of small islands and some very big financial centres, because it's not just small islands like Jersey. The City of London is an offshore finance centre and a tax haven. Luxembourg, Switzerland, Manhattan in New York is another offshore finance centre. Gradually they built up this parallel global economy which is designed to meet the needs of the rich and the powerful people of this world, including the world's biggest companies. And they've been rather audaciously establishing themselves through offshore companies, offshore trusts, shell companies, where they pay less tax, in many cases no tax at all, but they also avoid the regulation that we've been putting into place in the mainstream economies over the past half century. So to all intents and purposes, they've created a parallel economy and removed themselves from the economies in which most of us ordinary people operate.
John, can you take us through a specific example, a country or a person, for instance? What's your favourite?
I think my favourite is probably a fellow Australian of yours, actually, Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch set up News International all those decades ago. He now operates around the world. He's very big in the United Kingdom, the United States, across Europe. His empire is pretty global. It's established through over 800 companies, which are almost impossible to investigate because most of these companies are set up in these very secretive jurisdictions where it is impossible to get any relevant or useful information about the companies and the trusts that are established in these small islands and in these tax haven jurisdictions. And that's the important thing to bear in mind. All of this happens in an atmosphere of total secrecy. So when we're trying to investigate these things, we come up against brick walls time and time again. We say, okay, who owns this company? And you discover it belongs on paper to the clerk working in a lawyer's office somewhere in Bermuda or the Bahamas or somewhere. And there's no way of finding out who's actually behind this company. Now, this doesn't just mean that people like Rupert Murdoch end up paying virtually no tax at all.
Well, in some cases, John, in some countries, none at all. The Murdoch empire pays none at all. For instance, I read that in Israel, that the empire was paying nothing.
That's right. And the same in Britain for many, many years. In fact, for over a decade, News International, which has its most profitable publications in Britain, paid no tax at all. Now, look, the trouble is that a lot of people think, well, that's great. I'd love to not pay any tax. That'd be marvelous, you know. And the trouble is that there are lots of effects. First of all, it means that all of us think, well, the tax system is rigged, isn't it? So they pay no tax and we have to pay more. And that's true. It is happening. The more the wealthy people do this, the more middle-income and low-income people, including very poor people, have to pay tax, because politicians have been quietly adjusting to this new world by shifting the tax burden from the rich to the poor. And that doesn't just apply to Australia or the United Kingdom or to France. It applies to developing countries in particular, because it's developing countries in Africa that suffer worst from this problem.
Tax is a weighty matter, isn't it? And it must be hard to lighten it up, to actually get the message across in a way that appeals to the public and can be easily digested by people.
Look, I've spoken around the world now, and I always use PowerPoints as far as possible, because if you can visualize things, and I don't use kind of bullet points, I use photographs and this diagrams and all sorts of things, make it lively, and people can quickly get not the technical. Now, the thing is, the experts, they're paid to obfuscate the issue. They're paid to introduce all these words which people find it very difficult to understand. So they talk in terms of tax efficiency. Who can argue against tax efficiency? It's got to be a good thing. Efficiency is a good thing. So when Bono, for example, was taken apart last year because of his tax avoidance structures, you know, he justified it by saying, oh, well, it's a good thing to be tax efficient. And the International Herald Tribune pointed out, well, you know, you're tax efficient, but that means other people are paying more money. Is that a good thing? So, you know, we can make it very lively and we can take apart the language these people use, but they use the language for deliberate reasons. If that is to keep others, to exclude normal people from the discussions. So it's a weapon. And, we disentangle the language, we reconstruct the language, we adopt our own new terms. I mean, we created this term called profit laundering, laundering of profits to tax havens. And suddenly it doesn't sound quite so good being tax efficient.
No, it sounds clean, doesn't it? Yes, it sounds clean, like you're actually in the laundry cleaning something.
Yeah. All the time we read in the press about tax competition, how it's affecting countries and so on. Competition can't be a bad thing, can it? So we say, well, what about environmental competition? Is it a good thing for us to compete by saying, oh, well, you know, we don't mind if you come and pollute our rivers and cut down our trees because it's profitable? And then suddenly the language becomes complicated for them to use. So I think it's a really good idea to kind of look at the culture, look at the language, and deconstruct the way in which these people operate.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast through radios, computers and iPods throughout the world, like the one you're listening to now. I'm Chris Richards, and we're chatting today with John Christensen, who's now a campaigner for taxing profiteers, but in a previous life has been an economic advisor to the government of that infamous harbour of tax havens, Jersey. You held that position for 11 years, John. You would have got a good look at what politicians think about the pros and cons of tax havens. What are your observations about that?
Truth of the matter is that Jersey was going through a very important transition in the 1980s and the 1990s when I was there. It was moving from being an island that had a strong tourism industry, a horticultural and agricultural industry. It had some light manufacturing, and it was being captured and taken over as a tax haven by bankers and lawyers. And this transition was happening whilst I was an economic advisor there. Jersey's a very small island, and some of the politicians, to put it bluntly, were well out of their depth. So they, as far as they were concerned, many of them, to be frank, were making quite a lot of money out of this process. Some of them had been appointed as directors on the boards of some of the big banks operating in Jersey. So, for example, the head of the Jersey's Finance and Economics Committee, the equivalent to Minister of Finance, he sat on the board of Barclays Bank. And he had no experience of banking, no track record. What on earth was he doing sitting on the board of the bank? Well, we all know, of course, that he was there because he could do them political favours. So there was a lot of that going on. This is how small island tax havens actually operate in practice. I describe the whole culture there as the culture of the three monkeys. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Because if you do, you're very, very bluntly told there's a boat in the morning, which is a Jersey expression, mean if you don't like it, get the hell out of it.
Yes.
And there was a lot of pressure upon some of the people, including myself, but I was very high up. I was a very senior civil servant. They couldn't get rid of me. And I eventually resigned because I thought, well, I don't want to spend the rest of my life doing this.
And now you're an international dissident, a prominent international dissident, and you're dealing with governments and politicians around the world. I'm wondering what feedback you're getting from them about whether or not they are motivated to do anything about it, and if they're not, what the blockers are on that.
Okay, that's a very good question. I mean, I think a lot of politicians around the world and civil servants and senior academics and so on who really, really, really want this issue to move center stage. So there's a lot of people out there with tremendous goodwill on this subject. What are the blockages on it? Well, I mean, the biggest block of all, I regret to say, is the President Bush administration in the United States. In 2001, one of the first things his Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill did was to simply pull the plug on the OECD's initiative to tackle harmful tax competition. And in that one move, they simply stopped one of the world's principal initiatives to tackle this. There you have, in Paris, an OECD team of technocratic specialists, first class in that subject, who were doing something about it. They had some support from the Clinton administration, and the Bush administration pulled the plug. So, I mean,
why would they do that, John? I mean, what would motivate them to do something like that?
Quite simple. I would be very blunt about this. The Bush administration is payrolled by very big multinational corporations, including banks and oil companies, and it was not in their interests, and it still is not in their interest to start paying taxes in the countries where they make their profits. They will do everything to stop themselves from paying taxes anywhere. And they are amongst the biggest users of tax havens like Jersey. So that's been the key driver behind the resistance to this process.
That was John Christensen, a director and founder of the Tax Justice Network. You can hear more from John in the program Taxing Matters in the Radio New Internationalist archives. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Community Radio Stations 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking about people who are successfully fighting for a better world, bringing us inspiration and hope for a peaceful future. Like the campaigning work that's being done by the Tax Justice Network, which we've just heard about, the mounting campaigns to ban bombs have been enlisting support from the international community through the United Nations. In both cases, Norway is leading the charge. What makes a country a global advocate for a better world on issues outside its boundaries? Well, we think that's an issue that's definitely worth exploring, but not today, because now we're going to hear from another John, John Rodsted. He's the official photographer to the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, the team that won the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. John is still campaigning against the cruel and life-destroying legacy of war, the anti-personnel bombs left behind. And the pictures of this legacy, such as the bodies blown up when bombs just lying on the ground eventually explode, are helping to bring about a total world ban on landmines and, more recently, cluster bombs. John and his colleagues are lobbying internationally for countries to sign up to a treaty banning cluster bombs. When I talked with him last July, he explained first what cluster bombs were capable of doing.
Basically, a cluster bomb is an aerial-delivered big bomb which is just full of lots of little bombs. They can either be dropped from aircraft, they can be fired on rocket launcher systems, they can be fired with artillery. An average artillery shell with clusters in it would have about 86. So they're little like bell-shaped objects of this type, the type we saw in Lebanon. A single firing of a multiple launch rocket system puts in over 7,500. A single aircraft bomb would put in a bit over 600. So the bottom line is a saturation weapon. Whether it's the missile or the aircraft bomb or the artillery shell opens up in the air above the target, and a lot of these little bomblets come down, they rain down on top of the target and pretty well devastate what's down there. Now, they've got three functions to them. They've got a fragmentation casing, so when they detonate, they spit shards of red-hot, razor-sharp metal all over the place, and that will kill people. They've got a thing called a shape charge, which will pierce armour. So if it hits a vehicle, it's good for armour piercing up to about 10 centimetres. And a thing called a zirconian wad, which creates a fire. So if you hit a vehicle, you'll start fires in fuel tanks and the rest of it. Now, that's your military objective. But the bottom line is that when you fire 7,500 of these in one firing of a multiple launch rocket system, massive amounts of them fail to detonate as intended, which means it doesn't mean they won't go off. It just means they're left laying around over the old target. And we were seeing in Lebanon up to 40% failure rates on some of the firing. So do your maths, 7,500 on a firing, you can have 3,000 duds in a 1 square kilometre area.
So these little bomblets that haven't gone off, what needs to happen for them to explode, and what will happen when they do explode?
Well, what needs to happen to make them explode? Nothing. Tuesday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, puff of air, walk on it, touch it, look at it. It is that sensitive. From a bomb clearance team who comes in and deals with this, you don't move them. You don't pick them up and say, I'll take them away and destroy them somewhere else. You set a charge next to it and you blow it up where it is. They are incredibly sensitive. I can't emphasise that enough. I mean, working in these places, there is a science to how you go about it. I don't run in like some macho idiot and film away. There are ways of working in there. There's a piece of tape at the end of the bomblet. It's part of the arming mechanism. Literally, if the wind picks up, I get out of there because the wind can start these things detonating. It doesn't take much. There was a guy who got called out to when I was there, and he plucked some grapes out of a grapevine, and one fell out above his head and blew his head off. Mm. There was a fisherman just off the coast in Tyre who started fishing just a couple of days after the bombing finished, pulled up his fishing net, and this thing looks like a D-cell battery. It doesn't look like anything.
That's small.
Yeah, it's a little thing. Mm. And he just thought, what's this bit of rubbish, and went to pull it out and blew off both his hands and his face. A young boy I got called out to, they were shoveling away the rubble of his house that had been flattened, and the tree he was standing under was just touched by a truck. A cluster fell out, killed one kid and injured five of his friends.
Let's touch quickly on the smoking gun you got in Lebanon, the film of the unexploded bomblets. Why was this so useful?
The problem with trying to get a treaty created is that civil society can't make it happen. You need a sponsor government to do it. You need, you know, it's like asking the axe murderer to put down the axe. We've got to get one of them to actually do it. Well, we were getting along quite well with the Norwegians, and the Norwegian government, parts of the Norwegian government, were talking theoretically that a ban on clusters could be desirable. But then they find out they actually had cluster bombs in the military arsenal. So that scuppered that argument. So then we took it the next step and we said, okay, just at that time when we're having that argument, the war between Israel and Hezbollah happened in southern Lebanon, and the Israelis used a massive amount of cluster munitions. Now, I was after a specific proof that the M85 cluster bomb, which was the one with the self-destruct mechanism, exactly the same that was in the Norwegian arsenal, failed to function. And I did track that down. I did find very, very strong evidence of that, filmed it, photographed it, brought it back to Norway, and my colleagues from Norwegian People's Aid took that to government and they said, listen, your argument is void. It doesn't work. It creates a problem.
There was a lot of controversy about whether or not Israel did drop cluster bombs in Lebanon. And obviously, if there are a lot of cluster bombs around Lebanon now, it's still active warfare, isn't it? Even though officially Israel is not delivering the same extent of bombing in Lebanon that it was last year, the fact that there are all these little bomblets there just waiting to go off means that psychologically the people in Lebanon are on tenterhooks and are in a state of war, aren't they, continually?
Absolutely, and that's the saddest part, because key word to this, and put this word in the back of your head, legacy. You know, it's a legacy that goes in and stays on the ground. It does not go away. It doesn't wear out. It doesn't rust. It doesn't disintegrate. It stays there until either somebody blows themselves up with it or until somebody comes away and comes along and destroys it. Now, you know, we're talking about Lebanon, and what happened there was just horrendous. Let's go back 30 years and say Laos. Well, Laos is the most heavily bombed bit of real estate on this planet. I was in Laos doing a project a couple of years ago, and I was in areas in Laos where I had an unexploded cluster bomb every single square metre times hundreds of kilometres of land. The average people, the war finished in 1975, well, what do you want to do? Get on with your life, put a crop in, get some food, put a house up. The simple acts of doing stuff like that were life-threatening and have been life-threatening for those 30 years, and has totally helped them stay in a poverty trap that the country can't trade out of.
Well, they can't feed themselves either, because the agricultural system is wrecked because of the fear that you would have in digging up the land. I'm just wondering, what do governments say? What do they say about the reasons why they allow cluster bombs to be made in their own territories, and what do they say about using them as well?
Well, governments generally say, mind your own business. Mm. The response from the Israeli government over Lebanon was a one-line response saying the use was legal. End of story. They don't like being brought to bear and to answer for the consequences of what they've done. You know, no governments do. And 10 years ago, we got a treaty up and running which started bringing about a ban on landmines. Now we've got 3/4 of the world signed up to that treaty, which has been a phenomenal success. This is a carbon copy, talking about cluster bombs now, to what we did over 10 years ago then. We're bringing governments to bear to account and saying, you know, you cannot wage a war and use these weapons that go into the ground, stay in the ground, never go away, and deny safety and redevelopment to countries decades after the conflict's over. Cluster bombs, there's about 20 countries that the cluster bombs have been used in. I think I've worked in 17 of those countries. It's all the same.
Mm.
It's the same thing, different date, whether it's Afghanistan or Sudan or Bosnia or Kosovo or Laos or Vietnam, pick one. It is just another country that's just getting locked into this poverty trap, courtesy of how long was the war? 10 years, 1 week, 2 days, but they fired all this in. In Lebanon's case, all of the clusters, that war went for 34 days. All of the clusters were fired in the last 72 hours, the last 3 days, and they put in 4 million bomblets into the southern Lebanon.
So they wanted the legacy. It wasn't actually a weapon of war at that stage. It was actually the legacy they wanted then.
I believe so, but I mean, that's a question you'd have to ask the Israeli defence or Israeli government.
Mm. I'm just wondering now about the actual arms manufacturers themselves. Who makes these cluster bombs?
Well, the arms industry, I find, just one of the most incredibly insidious industries on earth. It's blood money. All sorts of countries, all sorts of companies in different countries can make different munitions and different weapon systems. But then who do you sell them to? You know, who should weapons be limited to? And you've got all sorts of people who've made big bucks out of either supplying to friendly nations, nations where you've got mutual defence pacts. And then you've also got situations where you find the illegal supply of munitions around the world. I was in Eritrea a number of years ago in 2001. and I was in a refugee camp down near the Ethiopian border, and these were Eritrean refugees that had had cluster bombs dropped on them by Ethiopia, and they were British cluster bombs. Now, there had never been a British trade in cluster bombs. Someone had illegally supplied clusters to the Ethiopians, and there'd been a black market movement there, and they were subsequently dumped on refugees. Then you've got the nation-state wars. For instance, Afghanistan in 2001, they got pounded by basically the Americans. So you find a heap of American clusters there. Then you've got people like Victor Boot, who's a Russian arms dealer who is living fat and happy in Moscow, who's been more responsible for just swamping the world with any sort of arms. You got a buck, he'll get it for you and get it to you, and he just sources it all out of the old Soviet Union. Victor Boot, as an example, supplied the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan with one side, and he supplied the Taliban with another one. So The bottom line is there's a wash of available arms around the world, and there are people saying, right, I can get a plane load of that, and I will deliver it to you wherever you want it. You got the money. So there's people out there making big bucks.
Absolutely.
Out of it.
That was international campaigner against cluster bombs, John Rodsted. We're certainly barracking for John and his work here. Listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking about ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things, like our next guest, a campaigner for global peace. In April, we talked to Herbert Dotchener. Sitting on the fence of an airbase he'd just visited in Manta, Ecuador, is a warning sign. Military base, no trespassing. It might as well read, Ecuadorians keep out. Since 1999, this airbase has been occupied by the United States, a forward operating location of the US military, just one of around 740 that are currently scattered in over 100 countries around the world. But not for much longer. A decision made by the Ecuador government means that the sign should come down in around 2009. Herbert Dotchener is from the Philippines office of the international organization Focus on the Global South, and he was part of the mass movement that persuaded the Ecuadorian government not to renew its lease on the airbase. Our conversation started with why the base was opposed in Ecuador.
There were many different reasons. Firstly, a lot of Ecuadorians felt the U.S. reneged on its promise and never delivered on the supposed benefits that were promised to the Ecuadorian people, like infrastructure, added job, and all that. At another level, it was also a rejection of uses of the military bases of the United States around the world. And many people saw that in Ecuador, as in many other places, these bases are used for wars of aggression, and that make people complicit in wars of aggression that they do not approve of and that they do not want to be part of. So it was also a rejection of the wars that the U.S. are conducting through these bases.
Is it also part of that growing movement in Latin America at the moment that is developing links amongst countries there to the exclusion of the U.S.? And I'm thinking here about Venezuela, Bolivia.
Yeah, I think it's definitely part of that. But it's not just anti-American. It's really more of a rejection of the domination of the U.S. in the internal politics across and within the Latin American countries. So I think this is definitely a manifestation of that move, that shift away from the U.S. that we're seeing in Latin America. But this is also part of a larger global development in which U.S. foreign military bases are being opposed by grassroots movements, social movements, anti-war movement, wherever they are. For example, in Italy, in Vicenza, there was a very large demonstration against an expansion of a military base there. In Okinawa, in Korea, in many other places, there have been strong movements against bases for decades now. But it's only now that these anti-basis movements are actually coming together and building a community.
Well, let's take a couple of examples. Let's start in Latin America. I understand Paraguay, which one would have understood to be quite conservative in these matters, has just removed legal immunity surrounding the bases. That will be a major discouragement for the US to not have a base in Paraguay now. Can you just explain to us why, Herbert?
Well, I think part of that has to do with domestic pressure that people in Paraguay brought to bear on the Paraguayan government. Another part of that has to do with the regional environment. I think the Paraguayan government was quite conscious of how the other governments, Bolivia, the other left-leaning governments in that region, reacted to its decision to allow U.S. military presence in their country. So in a sense, it got isolated by that. And so there have been moves within the Paraguayan government to move away from providing the only U.S. military presence in that part of the world.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the U.S. holds legal immunity close. It's one of the prerequisites almost to it having a U.S. base in a country. Why is that? What is so important about legal immunity for the U.S.?
It's very important because the U.S. is afraid that locals will bring them to court for what they call official duties. And these official duties are often accompanied by abuses, human rights violations, and other acts that may be considered criminal and that the locals want accountability for. And so you have cases, for example, in the Philippines, in Japan, in Okinawa, in which people want to bring the U.S. troops to court, but they couldn't because of the legal immunity that they enjoy.
And what about the rest of the world, Herbert? Places like Italy, like Okinawa, in terms of local opposition?
Well, in Okinawa, there's a very vibrant grassroots-based movement against bases there. And interestingly, one of these groups, they've been going out to sea every day for the last so many months in order to prevent the construction of a new base in Henoko Bay in Okinawa. And what's interesting about Okinawa is that even mainstream or conservative governments are joining the campaign against U.S. military bases. Mm. And this is because of the noise, the environmental contamination, the increase in crimes, in prostitution that foreign military bases usually bring. But at the same time, I think opposition to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan also played a role and contributed to increasing people's consciousness as to the uses of these U.S. military bases. And this is also the case in Korea, where there's been a very strong anti-war movement, which has consciously tried to make the links between the existence of foreign military bases in their country and the war in Iraq. And I think that's very important. That link is very important to make, because it's important not to see the foreign military bases in isolation as just lone-standing infrastructure that just happens to be noisy or that just happens to do a lot of damage to the local community, but to see it as part of a global war machine causing a lot of death and destruction around the world, and not just in their local communities.
A coalition of over 400 progressive people from all over the world came together in March in Ecuador to demand the closure of all foreign military bases worldwide. The focus is on foreign bases. Does that mean domestic military bases are okay, Herbert?
In that conference, it was decided that the focus is going to be on all foreign military bases and all other infrastructure used for wars of aggression. I think the decision to focus on foreign military bases was in recognition of the fact that all existing foreign military bases right now are used for aggression without exception, that they're used to project power, that they're used not for defensive purposes but for aggression, whether it be by the US, by China, by Russia, or by other countries. But there was also the recognition that 95% of all foreign military bases around the world are owned by the United States. And we all know what the United States use these military bases for. But at the same time, it was important to specify that the focus of the campaign will also include all other infrastructure used for wars of aggression, because we did not want to exclude what are considered by the U.S. as domestic military bases in places like Guam or Hawaii or Puerto Rico, where people are continuing to wage self-determination struggles and who do not see themselves as part of the United States. And we also did not want to exclude bases like the NATO bases in Europe, which are considered both foreign and domestic at the same time because they are owned by the countries in Europe. So these are technically not easily classifiable as foreign bases. So we had all these discussion on the complex configurations that bases take, and it was felt that it was important to make the distinctions.
Herbert, I'm just wondering, from the International Network for the Abolition of Foreign Military Bases point of view, and the meeting that was held in Ecuador in March, what was talked about in relation to China and its military or strategic base ambitions?
It wasn't really talked about as a separate topic, except that there was a recognition that China does have military bases, although nowhere near as many as the U.S., and that China is also, in many respects, being used as a justification for the further stay of foreign military bases in Asia, like in Japan and in Korea and in the Philippines. Moves to introduce U.S. military presence are often designed to contain China. And in fact, the latest Quadrennial Defense Review of the U.S., which is an important policy document, has already categorically singled out China as the next and the only possible competitor to the U.S. and the only threat to the U.S.'s sole position as the world's only superpower.
Very interesting, Herbert. There's one issue I would like to briefly touch on with you. You're from the Philippines. The Philippines government ordered the United States out in 1991, but it's now emerging that the US has had a permanent force stationed in the South for the last 5 years. More than 800 political activists have been killed since 2001. What involvement have the US forces had, do you think, in these extrajudicial killings?
Well, first of all, their presence in the South is something that they don't want us to know about because their presence in the Philippines is very controversial. I think what they want to do is to have as little visibility as possible because at the same time, they want to stay on for to be able to station themselves in that part of the Philippines which they consider as the hotbed of quote-unquote Islamic terrorism in Southeast Asia. Regarding the relationship between the U.S. presence in the Philippines and the extrajudicial killings, it may not be as direct. We do know that the U.S. military, the U.S. government, was involved in drafting the overall program of the Philippine military in its counterinsurgency war against the left here. And we do know that, and I personally believe that, there are elements within the military who are responsible for these extrajudicial killings as part of the intensifying campaign against the left, which is being seen more and more here as a threat because of their growing popularity and support among the people. We do also know that the U.S. provides over $60 million to $100 million in military aid every year for the last 5 years, and this has contributed considerably to strengthening the capacity of the Philippine military, and this has also allowed them to basically get away with human rights violations without any accountability.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the program, Herbert. I'm wondering, before you go, where can people go to read more about the International Network for the Abolition of Foreign Military Bases?
Well, they can go to the network website, which is www.no-bases.net.
That was Herbert Docena from the Philippines office of the International Organization Focus on the Global South. Hope to speak to you again soon, Herbert.
Thank you so much.
Bye for now. And if you want to hear more about the worldwide movement opposing military bases, have a listen to Base Matters, a program in our audio archives. I'm Chris Richards, and I'm being inspired by the powerful and passionate voices of our guests today. So far, we've heard about high-flying campaigns, but we're about to shine a spotlight now on an international campaign that's just getting started in the Muslim world to stop officially sanctioned stoning, which is the process of throwing stones at people until they die. There were two known executions in Iran by stoning in 2006. In July this year, we asked Farida Shaeed, a Pakistani sociologist who's on the campaign advisory board of the Stop Stoning Forever campaign, what these two people did to deserve a death like that.
In May 2006, a man and a woman were stoned to death near Mashhad, which is a major city in the east of Iran. They were accused of adultery. Any kind of intercourse outside the marriage bond is liable for stoning to death under the law.
And how many people are there in Iran at the moment sentenced to similar deaths, Farida?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I don't really have figures in front of me of how many people, but as far as the campaign is concerned and women's rights activists over the world is concerned, even one death is one too many.
Absolutely.
So while the numbers may not be that many, I think the whole point of the campaign is that this needs to be eliminated from the statute books as anything which is an acceptable punishment. And the people in Iran actually have been pushing for this campaign since 2000, so it's not that new. I think what's new is that there is some international visibility. But they worked very hard in 2000 to get the law changed. What they managed in 2002, in December, is that the head of the judiciary in Iran, Ayatollah Sharoubi, he placed a ban on the punishment being executed. But it still is on the statute books. And that's when they discovered that slowly there were incidences which were happening across the country, largely in very remote areas where people did not hear about them.
Mm.
So they started, when this one case in Mashhad came up with this man and the woman last year who were stoned to death, some women activists, and amongst them are some lawyers, got together and started investigating. What they found is that lots of people were not willing to believe them. Even people who were activists or progressive, otherwise they just felt that this can't be because the law has been suspended by the head of the judiciary. But when they went to investigate in Mashhad, they found the name of one other woman and then another woman and then another woman who had been convicted. Those women were not stoned to death. The lawyers and the activists managed to save their lives. But they couldn't get to everywhere in Iran where this was happening, and the law needed to be changed.
Now, is it just...
So that's where the campaign started.
Is it just adultery that attracts this horrendous death, or are there other crimes on the books as well that allow for execution by stoning?
No, execution by stoning is just for adultery, but adultery in English means that one party is married. This is for consensual sex. Even been applied in cases where the woman has been raped. Under what has been Muslim jurisprudence, the word that is used is zina. And zina can be any kind of sexual intercourse outside marriage.
Ah.
Zina bil jabr is rape. So you have the same kind of term being used for both, which in Pakistan at least has led to enormous confusion. And instead of protecting the survivors of rape, has led them to being liable to be punished.
So we have Iran and Pakistan still with this punishment on their law books. Are there other countries in the world where stoning is still on the law books?
I don't know about books, but I do know that it happens in Afghanistan. And I'm unsure about Saudi Arabia, but they have similar laws there. But it is something which, if you have in one country, gives legitimacy to introduce or to have it in other countries. So whereas there may be few places where this is legal. We do know, for instance, in Bangladesh, where it is not legal, villagers have decided, well, this is something that they can do because it is supposed to have religious sanction, which is vastly contested and opposed by many people.
Mm.
What we are attempting to do in the anti-stoning campaign is to internationalize the campaign. By internationalize, we really mean we would like the transnational women's movement to pick it up, because we think we need to exert pressure more than just from within one country or the other. And we also at some point think that it's necessary to maybe try and put this on the agenda of the UN. We're hoping to organize an international conference around this sometime later this year, just to give it that kind of publicity to allow people to come together and to brainstorm and to strategize on how to go forward. The Iranian campaign leaders have specifically stated in their letter to Ayatollah Sharoubi, they pointed out that Iran was a signatory and a state party to the Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, and that says torture is not allowed in punishment.
Yes. We should actually explain what is actually involved by stoning. Can you take us through the process?
Well, I have never seen it. I've only heard it described. In Iran, the man and the woman are not stoned together. The man and the women who are accused are often in different areas and stoned separately. The man is buried up to his waist. The woman is usually buried up to her chest. And people are asked to throw stones at them till they die. The descriptions are enough to render you ill. In Iran, what I understand has happened from the reports that the women activists have given and others have given is that wherever the stoning is supposed to take place, the local people are asked to be there. But at least at one or two incidences where they have given the details of what happened, it ended up that it was the judge plus the police and state officials who ended up doing it because nobody from the villages was either willing to or wanting to start stoning someone to death.
And that's a good sign, isn't it? That the people themselves are not actually participating in it.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent sign.
So in your campaign to eradicate stoning in Iran, what do the Ayatollahs and the government say to you?
I don't think the government has responded. I think the government right now is divided. And whereas a few years ago, the head of the judiciary, Shahrudaruddi, who had greater authority at that time, there, with the changing political scenario in Iran, the judiciary itself is now more split, and Mr. Shahrudaruddi doesn't have the kind of political or legal authority that he had earlier on in 2002 when he was able to put a stop to the stoning. The Iranians have tried to document cases because the first thing that's happened is when they brought up the case last year, everyone first denied that this took place from the government. So the government officials denied this took place. And as the Iranian campaigners are saying, the officials may carry it out, but it's usually in remote places, and the government itself seems to be uncomfortable with the fact that the punishment has taken place in places. They're embarrassed by it. They want to cover it up. They keep denying that this is happening. And it's only thanks to activists like Shadi Sadr and Mehboube Abbas Ghulizada and Asisa Amina, who in cases where women have and men have been executed, they've actually gone to the families to try and get the reports. Then they put the reports together and have managed to get this out into the public. They're relying largely on the internet and other sources to approach both the government itself as well as to reach people within Iran, because it is difficult to have any access to any other mainstream media, which will not publish any of this. And though the punishment exists for men and women, as with many of these practices, you find that there's many more loopholes for men to extricate themselves from this, and women are the ones who inevitably get punished. It's also not just any women. It's usually the very poor, the very marginalized, women who already are facing enormous problems, who end up being caught in this web. And one of the things that the campaign is trying to say is that, you know, these women may not have been in this position if they had been able to exercise other rights, like the right to divorce, the right not to leave an abusive husband, the right to have an independent source of income, etc. So they are linking it very much with the general move for women's equality and rights.
That was Farida Shaid, a director of Shikhat Gar, a resource centre for the empowerment of women based in Pakistan. She's also on the campaign advisory board of the Stop Stoning Forever campaign. And there are a myriad of campaigners like Farida and the other inspirational and brave people that we've heard from today on the New Internationalist website. Have a listen and a look at www.newint.org. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders. If you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Speak to you soon.